Well, once again, a hearty thanks and welcome to all of our friends and those interested in this project on Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific region. This is the final session, the sixth and final session of our conference on Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific region. And today we have the distinct pleasure of, first of all, welcoming a keynote address from one of our newer senior fellows at the Hoover Institution, retired Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, followed by a really, I am sure, invigorating and stimulating panel discussion among five of the leading experts on Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific region, who I will introduce after our keynote remarks. But first, it is my great honor and pleasure to give to you one of my favorite Hoover Institution colleagues, one of the leading thinkers and strategists of the period of great power rivalry and of new and distinct challenges to American national security that we have in the United States today, General H.R. McMaster. General McMaster is the Fuad and Michelle Ajami Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. I think you all know that he was the 26th U.S. National Security Advisor. He is I think a distinctive figure for his exemplary career, combining bravery on the battlefield with brilliance in strategic thinking. He is the author of a new book, which I highly recommend to all of you, that puts forward this analysis and strategic thinking on the national security challenges before us in the generation ahead. Many of which we're going to talk about today. That book is entitled Battlegrounds, The Fight to Defend the Free World. HR, thank you for joining us, and we now give the floor to you for your keynote remarks at this conference.
Well, Larry, thank you so much. What a privilege it is to be with all of you and to be part of this important conference. And thank you for that kind introduction. I feel a little bit like a student who's giving a talk in front of my professors, because this panel you're about to hear from is a panel comprised of people from whom I have learned so much over the years. And I'm really looking forward to that conversation. I just want to take a moment to thank you and Glenn and the whole team at Hoover for standing up this China Global Sharp Power Initiative as well. I mean, an initiative that has really taken off and done so much already, I think, to deepen our understanding of this crucial challenge to our security, our prosperity, and our influence in the world. So thank you for the opportunity to be with you at this important conference on Taiwan in the Indo-Pacific. It comes at a time when that we all might agree, I think, is also a dangerous time. Dangerous because the region and the world is experiencing the dual crises of the COVID-19 pandemic and a global recession associated with the pandemic. Dangerous because the Chinese Communist Party leadership, in the midst of these crises, believes that they are now in a position of relative advantage. Dangerous because the party seems intent to use that perceived position of advantage, not only to extend and tighten its exclusive grip on power internally, but also to export its authoritarian mercantilist model more aggressively as it employs a strategy of co-option, coercion, and concealment. Dangerous because the new tributary system that the party leaders envision aims to intimidate and create servile relationships that create exclusionary areas of primacy across the Indo-Pacific region and beyond. Dangerous because this strategy employs pernicious means of persuasion and sophisticated forms of economic aggression that threaten to reshape the international order. Dangerous because that new order would advance the Chinese Communist Party's ambition to dominate the data-driven global economy and achieve supremacy over global communications and logistics infrastructure. Dangerous because if the party succeeds, our world will be less free, less prosperous, and less safe. As this danger grew, many leaders across the Indo-Pacific and the world did little to confront it. Sadly, some even enabled it. Some even today continue to help the party conceal its aggression. The CCP co-opts elites in free and open societies with false promises of impending liberalization and the lure of vast profits. Consider, for example, the recent opening of its financial markets so investors can help the party fund its unprecedented peacetime military buildup, as well as programs meant to dominate advanced manufacturing and pioneer the application of emerging technologies critical to economic and military primacy. To set up the excellent panel discussions that we are about to hear, I thought I might discuss three misunderstandings about the danger associated with the party's aggression. Three misunderstandings that we might work together to correct. It is important to correct these misunderstandings because the party uses them as cover for its campaign of co-option, coercion, and concealment. It uses these three misunderstandings to get away with various forms of aggression internally as it perfects its Orwellian surveillance state, and externally through programs such as military civil fusion, Made in China 2025, and One Belt, One Road. The first misunderstanding is that Chinese aggression is the result of U.S.-China tensions or is a reaction to the Trump administration's description of China as a rival. This misunderstanding is a form of what we might call strategic narcissism. That is our tendency to view the world only in relation to us and undervalue the degree to which the other exercises authorship over the future. In this arrogant interpretation, the party has no aspirations of its own and has no volition except in reaction to the United States. But even the most cursory survey of recent Chinese Communist Party actions should correct this misunderstanding. Consider the party's deliberate persecution of doctors, journalists, and others who tried to warn the world about the COVID-19 outbreak. Consider the subversion of the World Health Organization. Consider the addition of insult to injury with the party's global wolf warrior diplomacy, attempting not only to obscure China's responsibility for foisting the pandemic on the world, but also to portray its response and its authoritarian system as superior to the response in our democratic societies. Consider the massive global cyber attacks on medical research facilities in the midst of the pandemic, and the punitive cyber attacks on Australia for having the temerity to suggest an inquiry into the origins of the virus. Consider the expulsion of international reporters and the party's recent announcement that it will continue to use hostage taking, such as the jailing of Canadians Michael Spavor and Michael Kovig, now for almost 2 years, and the roundup of so-called Taiwanese spies to coerce others to accommodate its various forms of aggression. Consider physical aggression on India's Himalayan frontier, in the South China Sea, in the Senkakus, and especially toward Taiwan. Consider the extension of the party's repression into Hong Kong, as Xi Jinping boasts of expanding concentration camps to accelerate his campaign of cultural genocide against the Uyghurs. Consider the brazen hypocrisy of Xi Jinping's posing as an environmentalist as China constructs 50 to 70 coal-fired plants a year and destroys coral reef ecosystems in the South China Sea. It should be clear that it was not the United States or even a mean Donald Trump that caused this behavior. So it should be clear that the CCP's aggression is not a U.S. problem. It is a whole world and especially free world problem. It is important that we correct this misunderstanding because its corollary among nations across the Indo-Pacific region is that the United States is asking them to choose between Washington and Beijing. But if there is a choice to be made, it is a choice forced upon them by Xi Jinping and his party. It is not a choice between Washington and Beijing. It is a choice between sovereignty and servitude. Thankfully, this conference is already helping correct this misunderstanding, as Dr. Transformagaro argues that small states need support to resist CCP coercion over fishing rights, trade deals, and diplomatic recognition. And as Marie Ma and James Tao have shown, global media and are increasingly subject to the CCP censorship and coercion, including threats of economic bankruptcy, intellectual theft, political pressure exerted through local officials, banning of publications from state-directed WeChat and Weibo platforms, and even physical threats to family members. The second misunderstanding derives from the first, that there is little international cooperation in the effort to counter CCP aggression because President Trump's America First, go it alone approach and the corollary that America is ceding leadership and influence in the world. But there is now a very high degree of international cooperation to defend against the party's aggression, and cooperation is growing. The Quad format of India, Japan, Australia, and the United States is invigorated. Consider the recent ministerial meeting in Tokyo. Law enforcement and intelligence cooperation against Chinese cyber warfare and cyber espionage is growing. Consider the multinational indictments and sanctions. They're really unprecedented against the party's main hacking organization, APT-10, in December of 2018. Economic cooperation is growing. Consider efforts to establish international standards for infrastructure investment or the various complaints against various forms of Chinese economic aggression brought to in front of the World Trade Organization. Democratic countries are working together to prevent China from subverting more international organizations and turning them against their purpose, as they did with the Human Rights Council, UNESCO, ICAO, and the WTO. In this conference, Jonathan Pryka highlighted international efforts to counter the CCP's concessional finance plans and aggression in the South Pacific. And Emily Mirerding described international arbitration on the development of oil and gas in the South China Sea. There is more to do. And whoever is sworn as President of the United States on January 20th must prioritize expanding this international cooperation. The third misunderstanding is that competition with China is a dangerous or even irresponsible approach because of the Thucydides trap that presents us with a binary choice between passivity and a destructive war. That is a false dilemma. And I would argue that passivity in connection with the Chinese Communist Party aggression in the South China Sea and elsewhere had put us on a path to conflict. Had we remained complacent under the strategy of engagement and cooperation, China would likely have become even more aggressive. Transparent competition can prevent unnecessary escalation and enable rather than foreclose on cooperation with China. But the party promotes the false dilemma associated with the Thucydides trap to portray efforts to defend against its aggression as simply the status quo power, the United States, trying to keep the rising power, China, and its people down. Calls to cooperate with China without reference to the need to defend against the party's increasing aggression reinforce that narrative. So when we hear the party make statements that portray its actions as only a response to the United States, or when some of our friends, lamenting in a tone of moral equivalency, that they are being forced to make a choice or arguing for accommodating the party's aggression through cooperation as an end in and of itself and the only alternative to war, we should all help correct those misunderstandings. It is important to correct them because they provide cover for the party's aggression and a rationalization for those who are eager to shrink from competition in pursuit of short-term profits. If we allow these misunderstandings to persist, we are aiding the Chinese Communist Party in achieving its vision for the Indo-Pacific region and beyond. And if the party succeeds, our world will be less free, less prosperous, and less safe. I look forward to the excellent discussion and deeply appreciate the opportunity to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you, HR, for those eloquent, bracing, and certainly provocative remarks. And intellectual provocation is what we want in a conference like this, particularly when we have five such great panelists. I should have begun by introducing myself. I am Larry Diamond, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. And with Glenn Tifford, I've been leading both the project, this project on Taiwan in the Indo-Pacific region, and our project on China's global sharp power. And of course, these two projects, as you can see, are in intimate and constant interaction with one another. Before we go on, I do once again want to acknowledge my deep thanks to the Taipei Economic and Cultural Office in San Francisco for its support of this project at the Hoover Institution. And I now want to introduce our five panelists who will speak in the order in which I'm going to introduce them now collectively. Dr. Michael Ostlund is the Payson J. Treat Distinguished Research Fellow in Contemporary Asia at the Hoover Institution. He's a leading historian of US policy in Asia and is the author of, most recently, Asia's New Geopolitics, Essays on Reshaping the Indo-Pacific Region. Elizabeth Economy is our newest senior fellow colleague at the Hoover Institution. She just joined us in September. We are so thrilled to have her. She's also senior fellow for China Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. She is, of course, an expert on China's domestic and foreign policy and author of the recent seminal book, The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State. Retired Admiral James Ellis is an Annenberg Distinguished Visiting Fellow at Hoover. He led the United States Strategic Command and commanded, in particular, of possible relevance for this discussion, the USS Independence Carrier Battle Group during the Third Taiwan Strait Crisis in 1996. He now leads an effort at Hoover to study and convene dialogue around future national security challenges. And he is the former president and CEO of the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations. Thomas Finger is a Shorenstein A. Park Fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies. And he is formerly the Deputy Director of National Intelligence and Chairman of the U.S. National Intelligence Council, as well as a former Assistant Secretary of State for intelligence and research, and a widely experienced policymaker. He recently co-edited Fateful Decisions, Choices That Will Shape China's Future. Finally, I welcome my colleague and co-editor of our recent study, China's Influence and American Interests, Orville Schell, the Arthur Ross Director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society. A longtime China observer, I would describe him as certainly one of the deans of China studies in the United States. He is also the former dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. So thank you all, panelists, for joining us. I hope in the context of your remarks, your thoughts, your responses to H.R. McMaster. You'll speak to three questions that have been lurking in this conference, and certainly in H.R.'s brilliant keynote address. What does the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, seek for China in terms of its role in the Indo-Pacific region and globally? Secondly, what does this mean for Taiwan and its democracy and its security? Should we worry that with the rapid process of destruction of Hong Kong's autonomy, that Taiwan is next in the sights of the Chinese Communist Party state? And third, of course, how should the U.S. and its allies respond? So with that, Misha Auslan, the floor is yours.
Larry, thank you. Thank you so much for having me here. The World Series just ended. I feel a little bit like a bat boy at the World Series right now, following or going before people from whom I've learned so much.
I feel like a long-suffering Dodger fan that finally got relief after 32 years, but please go ahead, Misha.
Occasionally the bat boys get to go on the field, and that's a little bit how I feel today. You took the words out of my mouth. HR's bracing comments on the role of the CCP. He called his the three misunderstandings, and in that spirit of our Chinese friends, I'd like to offer the three rethinks for the U.S. and hopefully through those get to some of the questions that you just posed for us. The first rethink for the U.S. is rethinking statecraft and the larger question of how prepared we are for what appears to be a period of great power competition that we're entering into. I think for so long we had one view of first of all, what we wanted from our China relationship, and rightfully so, a cooperative relationship, and built policies around that. And we've been struggling, I think, for the past 3-4 years with recognizing that we were in a new era. But we're past that, I think. We're now past the point of saying we need to reconsider both the strategy and the ends, or we're past the point of actually accepting, I think, on the part of many people, that we have a challenge. Some would say a threat, some would say a challenge, some would say a reset. So now we're in the harder part of actually trying to figure out what to do. And that's where the three rethinks come from. So the first one, again, rethinking U.S. statecraft. The fifth plenum of the party, the Chinese Communist Party, is this week. It's basically just concluded. They released a communique. And interestingly, instead of looking just over the next 5 years, which is what traditionally is done at the plenums, this one actually looked out to 2035, set goals for the party, for the government, for the country, 15 years out. Our friend Yan Shuitong was quoted as saying, "This shows a new strategic seriousness on the part of China, a maturity, and a confidence of being able to look out into the future, both domestically as well as regionally and internationally." And I would say that then the challenge is thrown to us. Is our statecraft up to this challenge? Have we thought out where we want to be in 2035? And as a historian, I actually take comfort in the concept of the free and open Indo-Pacific. It's actually what we have put at the core of U.S. policy since the 19th century. It's not new. And it's something that we have worked with, whether we've had national power to carry it out or not, whether it's the open door, whether it's our role with partners and allies or the like. But that, as an aspirational goal, is only part of the way. We need a much more consistent all-of-government U.S. strategy. That's, I would say, is the first rethink. The second rethink is one that I think is a little bit harder for us to get our heads around, which is that we've assumed for a very long time that the engagement that we rightfully wanted with China would in turn give us some measure of influence. I don't mean in terms of telling China what to do, but that it would create entry points, it would create levers, it would create understandings where we could express our goals for this relationship more broadly, whether it was vis-a-vis Taiwan, vis-a-vis our allies or the like, and allow us to work with China. Well, it's interesting if you look at the dual circulation strategy that the party has been talking about recently and was again stressed at the plenum. What that is really in essence a partial decoupling strategy. We're used to thinking that it's only the United States that wants to decouple from China, but in essence, the dual circulation strategy calls for a level of decoupling China from an uncertain international economic and indeed security environment so that it can protect its own interests in the views of the party. Now, if it is successful in the dual circulation strategy, and I'm interpreting a little bit as to what I see them trying to do, then the rethink we have is, do we have the ability to influence the choices of the government and the party as much as we thought? Meaning, if there is a partial decoupling, does that mean there are less points of contact between our two governments, our two societies, our two economies, so that we are going on different tracks? And we are therefore able, less successfully perhaps, to signal the preferred policy goals that we have vis-a-vis Taiwan, first and foremost, in terms of this conference, vis-a-vis freedom of navigation, freedom of aerial overflight, freedom of internet access, and the like. So the second rethink is, do we really have the type of influence and access inside China going forward, 5 years, 10 years, and 15 years, as we thought we would have? And that leads me to the third rethink for U.S. strategy, which gets very much to the title of this session, Security and Stability. Are we at the point of having to rethink our security posture? This, I think, is where in particular Admiral Ellis will have a great deal to say, as will Tom Finger, having worked on this for so many decades. We're in a new era where our capacity, not our capabilities, but our capacity to affect the desired security ends that we want are more in question than ever before. They're in question because of our continuing worldwide commitments, but they're in question because we face a challenger or a near-peer competitor, as is sometimes phrased in DC, that can do things that we haven't had to try to respond to or counter or protect ourselves from for a very long time. So is our capacity up to the standard that we need? And secondly, then, roles and missions in this new rethink, particularly when we think about Taiwan. Of course, we just announced a new arms sales package, but we must think about whether the commitments we have made are those that we can carry out, whether they need to be changed and tailored in a new era. HR talked about APT, talked about cyber threats. Where are we in responding to those? So I would offer those as the three rethinks for the US in order to remain credible to our friends and allies, to Taiwan, to Japan, to the others in the region. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Misha. You've given us a lot to chew on. And we now turn the floor over to Elizabeth Economy.
Thanks so much, Larry. It is terrific to be here as part of this last panel of what's been a truly outstanding conference and set of discussions over the past few weeks. I'd like to speak briefly to three points, and actually they're the three points that you asked us to speak to. So first, what is the nature of the challenge that China poses in the Asia-Pacific region and beyond? Second, what is the role of Taiwan in this context? And third, what are the steps that the United States, Taiwan, and others might take to ensure Taiwan's continued well-being and political and economic autonomy? So first, what is the nature of the China challenge? I think the heart of Xi Jinping's ambitions, really his great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation and the Chinese dream, reflects three objectives. The first objective is the unification of China. And without that, there is no great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. And unification means, in the first instance, just the periphery of mainland China. So Xinjiang, Tibet, and Inner Mongolia. Beyond that, it means the core interests, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and the South China Sea. The second objective is that China, not the United States, is the predominant power in the Asia Pacific. Xi Jinping has stated very clearly that it is for Asians to manage their regional and security affairs. Chinese-led institutions and arrangements in Asia, such as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, and the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership reinforce the idea of PRC leadership throughout the region. And the third objective is to create an international system in which norms, values, and standards more closely reflect PRC policy preferences. As Xi Jinping has said, he wants China to lead in the reform of the global governance system. And we see this first through China's Belt and Road Initiative, which was initially designed to connect poor interior regions of China to external markets in the rest of Asia, Europe, the Middle East, and Africa through hard infrastructure, such as ports, railroads, and highways. It then morphed and evolved into a digital Silk Road that includes fiber optic cables and e-commerce and satellite systems, and now a digital currency. There's a political component to the Belt and Road Initiative, where China's training officials in other countries on how to control the internet, how to do real-time censorship, how to manage civil society and the media. And there's a security element. China no longer identifies its security as bounded by the Asia Pacific. It has a global vision that's rooted in its position as a global trading and investment power with human and financial capital everywhere in the world. We've seen China establish its first logistics base in Djibouti, and I think there are certainly more bases to come. And China also looks to transform norms and standards in global governance institutions, such as the United Nations, to have them reflect Chinese preferences. I think this is particularly evident in human rights, in internet governance, in development finance, and technology standards through its China Standards 2035 initiative. So when we look at China today, we can see that it's transforming the geostrategic and geoeconomic landscape at three different levels. First, in its own backyard in the sovereignty realm. Second, on the ground by spreading its influence through the Belt and Road Initiative. And third, in international institutions and global governance. So how does Taiwan fit into these ambitions? It is, of course, central to Xi's ambition to realize Beijing's sovereignty claims and unify the country, and therefore central to the entire narrative of the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. At the 19th Party Congress in October of 2017, Xi said that unification with Taiwan was one of the 14 must-do items for China to achieve its great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation by 2050. Over the past several years, we've seen that China has made significant advances in asserting its sovereignty claims in the South China Sea. And we've witnessed just over the past year, as HR suggested, how it's undermined the one country, two systems governance framework in Hong Kong that was supposed to endure until 2047. And it's begun the process of grafting the mainland's political system onto that of Hong Kong. In effect, Beijing is transforming Hong Kong into just another Chinese city that is subject to the same constraints on political and economic life that mainland Chinese citizens experience. Where China has not realized any success to date, however, has been in advancing its sovereignty claims over Taiwan. During the period of Ma Ying-jeou's presidency from 2008 to 2016, China tried to induce Taiwan to integrate more closely with the mainland through trade and investment, people-to-people exchanges, by offering Taiwan greater space on the international stage. It stopped buying off Taiwan's diplomatic allies. It allowed Taiwan to participate as an observer in the International Civil Aviation Organization and the World Health Assembly. But that was all with the expectation that Taiwan was voluntarily moving forward to some form of a one country, two systems framework. I don't think that was ever the intention of the majority of the Taiwanese people, but Beijing could at least maintain the fiction that this is what was happening. Over the past 4 years, of course, we've seen a much more coercive PRC policy toward Taiwan, halting cross-strait political dialogue, reducing Chinese tourism and students going to Taiwan, meddling in local elections, adopting threatening military rhetoric and posture, and constraining Taiwan's international space by once again buying off more of Taiwan's remaining diplomatic allies, coercing international business to recognize Taiwan as part of the mainland, and refusing to allow Taiwan to participate as an observer in the International Civil Aviation Organization, or critically, as we saw during the pandemic, in the World Health Assembly. While these trends have been going on for a few years, I think we are at a particularly dangerous moment for several reasons. First, there is no more unification fiction to be maintained on Taiwan. President Tsai had a resounding re-election victory. She made it clear that she considers Taiwan to be an independent country, even using those words. And even the KMT has dropped its pro-unification stance on its party platform, as well as its commitment to the 92 consensus. That leaves Beijing without a clear partner in Taiwan. Second, Taiwan is rapidly becoming the darling of the international community. It is a thriving democracy, and it did a spectacular job of managing the coronavirus. Both of these facts directly threaten PRC triumphalism around its own response to COVID-19 and the argument that its model is somehow best suited to addressing these types of challenges. You also have a very appealing set of leaders, frankly, including Tsai Ing-wen herself, Minister of Science and Technology Audrey Tang, Taiwan's representative here to the United States, Bi Kinshao. The more success that Taiwan attains, the more untenable Beijing finds the situation to be. Third, Xi Jinping is impatient. Taiwan is the last piece at the center of the unification puzzle. It is a core interest, and he has made a number of statements that are concerning. Reunification should happen sooner rather than later. We can't put this off for future generations to manage. And he has made clear that the use of force is a possibility. And finally, the US has become more deeply involved in elevating Taiwan's standing on the global stage. I recognize that this is in support of Taiwan and is an effort to provide it greater protection, but I also think we are in danger of raising the risk of provoking Beijing into action. So let me just finish up with a few words on what I think the US should consider in terms of moving forward. First, I think the United States should reaffirm the basic diplomatic framework of US-China relations, reiterate the US commitment to the three communiques, but also, of course, to the Taiwan Relations Act. Calm the waters by reassuring China that the fundamentals of the bilateral relationship have not changed. Second, multilateralize the Taiwan issue. This is a good moment to engage other actors in Asia and in Europe in support of Taiwan. There's growing and deepening distrust of Beijing because of its actions in Xinjiang and Hong Kong, as well as its wolf warrior masked diplomacy. Europe is becoming more interested in Asian security issues. And there's a sense, I think, a growing sense that democracies must stick together. All of this should be framed as a defense of freedom of navigation, free trade, and good governance. Third, embed Taiwan in the Free and Open Indo-Pacific Initiative. I think this is already happening. Workshops with Japan, Australia, Taiwan, and the US on COVID-19, a few infrastructure investment partnerships with the United States and Japan. I think more of this needs to be done. Fourth, watch Xi Jinping's language and actions. If you track his statements and actions around Hong Kong, you can see the intensification of rhetoric, which was unmatched by steps that he took to exert greater control. I think we need to be very sensitive to the type of ratcheting up of rhetoric, particularly around China's military action that we're seeing coming out of Beijing. And finally, I think the United States should de-escalate in terms of its rhetoric. It's time for us to talk softly and perhaps find a big stick, since I'm not sure we actually possess one right now. I don't think we should be passing more legislation on Taiwan. I think the essential question that we need to think about is whether Taiwan would rather suffer Hong Kong's fate or wait perhaps another 20 years until she has passed from the scene and earn a real chance at full diplomatic recognition. I'll stop there. Thanks very much.
Well, you've really put a lot on the table. I knew this was going to be a great session, and it's already exceeding my expectations, and it's going to do so even more in the next several minutes. So, Admiral Ellis, the military challenge has already been invoked. You've seen it up close. We look forward to your remarks.
Thanks, Larry, and thanks again for allowing me to be a part of this. I am going to address your three questions, but through that lens that Misha talked about of the big stick element of national security, and I think that's appropriate. What we're all looking for is an ability to encourage appropriate adherence to norms of behavior and deterrence in the final analysis of inappropriate actions or rash actions on the part of all players in the region. But we need to understand that deterrence is at its heart at least a two-party process, and we can't be guilty of mirror imaging and assuming that we know what others are thinking, and nor can we in the final analysis confuse the probability of an outcome with the consequences of an outcome. And so, as Elizabeth noted, in recent years, particularly last year, Xi Jinping declared unification of China and Taiwan to be an inevitable requirement for the historical rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. The PLA, and even in recent months, has stepped up pressure on Taiwan, sending warplanes across the median line that long served as an unofficial maritime boundary, now publicly denying that the line even exists or has any significance at least. And then finally holding large naval drills off several parts of Taiwan's coast. And we have come to appreciate, or some have, that of all the potential friction points with China in the national security domain, many defense strategists identify a conflict over Taiwan as the key scenario, with all others being lesser included offensives, pun intended. They believe that the defense establishment should focus on preparing the military, our military, the Western military, for a Taiwan scenario with our allies, of course, in the region, above all others. And the United States needs to be able to effectively defend Taiwan, because it's important to frustrating China's strategy to achieve the hegemony in the region, and adapting the U.S. military to be able to defend Taiwan will be hard, but it is necessary and will also allow the United States to defend other allies as required in Asia against Chinese encroachment. This week, or at least 2 weeks ago, The Economist published an article titled, "Defending Taiwan is Growing Costlier and Deadlier." And in my remarks in your first panel, I noted that the oft-quoted 2015 RAND Corporation study notes that Chinese military capabilities have improved dramatically relative to those of the United States over the nearly 2.5 decades since the so-called Third Taiwan Straits crisis, to which responded 2 U.S. carrier battle groups. As you mentioned, I commanded the initially responding carrier group, an element of the 7th Fleet, aboard the appropriately named USS Independence. Nevertheless, the PLA entered the 1990s so far behind the U.S. military in so many areas that Chinese modernization had few immediate consequences and, quite frankly, didn't excite much interest or alarm. It was not until the mid-2000s that the cumulative weight of PLA modernization began to coalesce into a significant challenge to U.S. regional primacy. I simply could not operate 2 carrier battle groups today where I was able to do so with impunity 24 years ago. Even just a decade ago, China had 4 times as many warships as Taiwan. Today, it has 6 times as many. It has 6 times the number of warplanes and 8 times as many tanks. China's defense budget, merely double Taiwan's at the end of the 1990s, is now 25 times greater. In a war game conducted earlier this year, the Center for a New American Security assumed that Taiwan would fight tenaciously and that America would have access to weapons still under development. Even under those rosier circumstances, the island survives at least after 10 notional days of combat, but only at a huge cost. The seas around Taiwan would look like no man's land at the Somme, notes Christopher Daugherty of CNAS. Fear of such losses might deter an American president from entering the fray, but incurring them might stiffen American resolve. America and its partners can use this dynamic to their advantage, says Bridge Colby, a former Pentagon official. If American troops were to disperse in allied countries like Japan and draw on allied support to repel a Chinese attack, China would have to choose between striking a wide range of targets beyond Taiwan and outraging American and Asian public opinion, or sacrificing military advantage. But, you know, to be honest, many American intelligence officials, and I defer to Tom Finger on this, do not currently think that China is about to unleash that firepower. The PLA's amphibious fleet has grown slowly in recent years, and China has never held even a single exercise on the scale that would be required for a D-Day type campaign. Indeed, no country has assaulted a well-defended shore since America did so in Korea in that conflict decades ago, and with good reason. It's difficult. At Incheon in South Korea in September of 1950, the last amphibious combat operation of any size, the invading forces included 230 ships, many of them large attack cargo vessels and comparably sized troop transport. China lacks such a heavy lift capability, though it is planning to build several amphibious assault ships comparable to our USS Wasp class. It must rely instead on masses of fishing boats, some large enough to transport a tank or similar armored vehicle, to carry an army of thousands of their equipment across the waters and sustain them through many days of combat. This Dunkirk in reverse would be very, very challenging. how large a force would be needed. Lyle Rose, author of Power at Sea, opines that even if China feels compelled to proceed, it doesn't have the resources to mount a successful amphibious operation across those 118 miles of turbulent waters. His research at the end of World War II in the Pacific revealed that planners at Pearl Harbor and the Pentagon agreed no less than 12 war-hardened divisions would have been required to subdue Japanese forces in Taiwan. No member of the People's Liberation Army, from general to the meanest man in the ranks, has ever heard a shot fired in anger, at least not in intense modern combat. But the PLA would face potentially a native army fighting in its own fields, streets, and homes, one that might be weakened but not neutralized by fifth column agents. And this is hugely different than throwing rocks and bottles at Indian troops on the Himalayan frontier. It's poor preparation for over-the-beach operations in Taiwan. But there are negative factors on the other side of the straits as well. Alas, Taiwan's preparedness and its will to fight both look a bit shaky. The sad truth is that Taiwan's army has trouble with training across the board, says Tanner Greer, an analyst who spent 9 months studying the island's defenses last year. I've met military observers who have never seen their own mortars fired. Despite longstanding efforts to make the island the indigestible hedgehog, Taiwan's armed forces are still overinvested in warplanes and tanks. And as Misha noted, that's still continuing with the most recent package of F-16s. Many insiders are accordingly pessimistic about its ability to hold out. Mr. Greer says that of two dozen conscripts he interviewed, only one was more confident in Taiwan's ability to resist China after going through the conscript system. Less than half of Taiwanese polled in August evinced a willingness to fight if war came. Given that, it's also fair to ask if the American people would support the level of intervention and strategic risk required to defend Taiwan, given, as I've learned through your seminar here, that Taiwan contributes less than 2% of its gross domestic product to its own defense, despite living in a dangerous neighborhood only 100 miles from China. It does not maintain a well-trained and motivated reserve force. And despite drafting asymmetric warfare concepts against a Chinese invasion, has not brought those capabilities into being. I'm an old fighter pilot. In my favorite line from the movie Top Gun, the exasperated captain yells at an unrepentant maverick, "Maverick, your ego is writing checks your body can't cash." Even if America is willing to come to Taiwan's aid, that's no use if it is not capable of doing so. As a historical side note, in the 1958 Kinmen crisis, the United States dispatched 6 carrier battle groups to the region and began escorting Taiwanese resupply ships. In 1996, I was in the neighborhood and responded within hours, but it took 10 days to get a second carrier strike group to the region. Unless and until the United States adjusts its regional commitments, maintaining even the capability to meet those commitments will require the ongoing review of procurement priorities, concepts of operations, basing posture, and importantly for this conference, political military relationships with regional partners, as well as engagement with Beijing, as Elizabeth notes, to reduce the likelihood that China and the United States will ever turn weapons on one another. I should end, given the diplomatic focus of you and a number of our panelists, with a quote from George Kennan, not in one of his books, but in a speech he gave at the National War College in 1946, when he said, "You have no idea how much it contributes to the general politeness and pleasantness of diplomacy when you have a quiet little armed force in the background. People who are otherwise very insulting and very violent become just as pleasant. Why, they couldn't be nicer if they belonged to the same golf club and played golf together every Sunday morning." I've been to China, and the Chief of Naval Operations with whom I was traveling brought the head of the Chinese military, the Chinese Navy, a brand new golf club, and we played golf in the shadow of the Great Wall. I'm not implying that that's where we're headed, but I do think that Kennan's quote has relevance here. This is a credibility issue, and we must ensure that, as Elizabeth notes, that even though we want to talk softly in diplomacy and and agreements are the outcome that we want, that that stick is still very important. Thank you.
Which is why Theodore Roosevelt is one of my favorite presidents. Tom Finger, Jim Ellis has already made reference, as we all would, to the need to hear your voice. So the floor is yours.
Thank you, Larry, and thanks to Glenn for inviting me to be part of this panel and the conference. There have been very, very good presentations by those who have already spoken this afternoon. I also have three questions or points that I want to address, but they're not exactly the same ones that Larry posed. But let me frame it by saying that my perceptions and my remarks are shaped by some experiences in Washington. One is, in 23 years there, I'm afraid I became quite jaded about political statements by politicians in the United States and in other countries, and take them with a large grain of salt. And I'm not predisposed to equate bold pronouncements with actual achievements, that translating plans into reality is difficult. The second aspect of the Washington experience is my involvement and leading role in five of the global trends projects undertaken by the National Intelligence Council. And for one of those, the one we did in 2008, partly as an exercise to understand what we were doing, we went back to 1900 and tried to look forward as the global trends has done since 1996, 15 years. And we determined with pretty high confidence that no one had predicted or would have predicted what turned out to be the watershed developments in each of the successive four-year looks, 15 out years out into the future. Things change. And some of them are predictable and some of them are not. And in thinking about what to do about China and what lies in store in the Indo-Pacific region, it seems to be imperative to do a better job than we have. And I mean broadly, not the panel this afternoon, to identify what the baseline trajectory is. Where are events headed? Other questions about what drives, but where are they going if nothing changes? If there are no policy interventions to reinforce or change the trajectory of events? The importance of this to me was driven home by the many, many policy officials I supported over the decades, who always wanted to know explicitly or implicitly when brought some piece of intelligence or analysis, do I have to do anything about this? Can I do anything about it? Do I have to do anything about it now? What are the chances that I'll make things worse instead of making them better? So getting that baseline understanding down, it seems to me, is critical. And that leads me to three questions that I think need to be answered by everyone who is thinking about the China challenge. The first is, what drives and shapes China's behavior? Is it Xi Jinping, his personality, his proclivities, his preferences? Is it, as Liz suggested, is it the Communist Party of China, as HR indicated in his remarks? Or does it do what it does and have the goals it does because it's China? That if China were to become a democratic country tomorrow, how much of its behavior would change and how much of it is a function of how the Chinese people, the Chinese nation, sees its role in the region and the world? Or does it act as it does because it's a big country and it has certain capabilities and aspirations that change the name of the leadership team and you get the same behavior? Or is it a function of its stage of development and its national priorities? Is it acting out of supreme confidence or considerable uncertainty and insecurity about its domestic situation and its plan? I don't have definitive answers, and it's in the time allotted, I'm not going to try to speculate on these, but I think they have to be faced and addressed specifically. If we are to devise an appropriate understanding and appropriate response to shape events in ways that presumably will lead to a different outcome than that of the baseline scenario, because most of the baseline scenarios that are sketched out lead to endpoints that are not particularly conducive to American interests. I think China's driven an awful lot by slowing growth inside China, decreased ability to have performance-based legitimacy, increasing demands from an attentive Chinese population, expectations. 70% of the population knows nothing except continued high growth and success. Meeting demands for healthcare, elder care, education, moving up the technology ladder, support for the military, it's already deployed, Belt and Road, is going to compete for resources that are not growing and not going to grow at anywhere near the rate of miracle growth. And there'll be competition. And it'll be political judgments about how much to move from one area to another. The second broad question is, will China or the party or Xi or whoever the driving actor is, will they succeed? That China, Xi have announced many, many goals. I tried to think top of the head, how many Chinese leaders have declared that unification with Taiwan must be achieved in 5 years over the 55 years that I've been working on China? And the short answer is all of them. All of them. That doesn't make it a trivial problem. That in many ways, the concern about mainland tolerance of the current situation looks more problematic now than it did a few years ago. That after 4 decades of steadily decreasing risk of getting into the kind of a conflict in the Straits that Admiral Ellis referred to, the trajectory seems to have changed. It's getting more risky. But there are lots of other dimensions to this, that civil-military fusion, Made in China 2025, these are marvelous aspirational proclamations. Can they succeed? If we think that Made in China 2025 can succeed, why don't we have an industrial policy? If we think they're better at doing things than we are, maybe we should be borrowing some things. Or do some of the contradictions in the system, the injunctions for people to be entrepreneurial, think out of the box, followed the next sentence, but don't color outside the lines, that the restrictions, the decoupling from the world that Misha referred to, most of this is from the Chinese side because they fear contamination by liberal foreign ideas. They put too many constraints on their people. The idea that China, unlike any other society, is going to be able to have innovative monopolies. Well, maybe. but that seems improbable to me. They'll succeed at some things and fail at others. One of the things that's clearest to me is somebody who looks at international relations is that China's relations with give or take every single country in the world have deteriorated over the last 5 to 7 years, over the period of Belt and Road, over the period of Xi Jinping ascendancy, that the goals are there. In some cases, minor accomplishments or specific achievements are there. But this looks like a classic case of winning some battles and losing the war, certainly for hearts and minds. China has not become an ideal aspirational goal for anybody. And it's become more worrisome to everybody. Finally, what should we do? What's the proper response once we think we have a reasonably clear understanding of what drives China, what it's attempting to do, the prospects for success in specific policy realms, as well as in aggregate, which things will succeed and which will fail if we do nothing, which successes would be advantageous to us and we should take actions to support them, which ones would be detrimental to our interests broadly defined and require some type of countermeasures unilaterally or more of them multilaterally. The world is ripe for collective action in lots of arenas, and managing the challenges that exist independent of China and are exacerbated because of China are ones where finding partners should be pretty easy. Devising a strategy to work with partners is the much more difficult one. Let me close by saying what I think this panel is underscoring, and when Orville adds to it, will underscore even more, is that we're looking at a country in flux, a country with a lot of moving parts, in a world that is very much in flux, in transition with moving parts. Extrapolating from today into 5 years into the future, which is a pretty short time for doing military planning, a very long time for doing political, I simply close with the reminder that 5 years ago, I would hazard to guess that nobody on the panel and nobody on this webinar would have predicted the U.S. behavior that we have seen over the last 5 years. Let me stop there.
Great. Thank you so much, Tom. And finally, on this round, we welcome our friend, my dear friend and co-editor, Orville Schell.
Well, thanks, Larry. It's really nice to be here. And I have to say, this has been a wonderful series. I've listened to most of them and learned a lot. Let me maybe pick up where Tom left off. I think that if you look at China historically, I mean, what you see is over the past century, a country that has tried on one solution after another. It's tried, in effect, to kind of reinvent itself in serial fashion. And I won't go through the whole litany of different guises in the past century, but I think what we see in Xi Jinping is yet another kind of a taking on of a certain posture, a certain set of costumes. And it's a bit of a split personality, I would have to say. If you take the Xi Jinping that addressed Davos in 1917, and you know he spoke about, he said something to the effect of, we can't let ourselves be locked in a dark room. He came out the great champion of globalism. And if you look at what they did with the AAIB, even with the Belt and Road, If you look at their efforts in a somewhat civilized fashion to spread their influence, it's not easy to cavil with every aspect of it. Some of the things they've done lately with Xi Jinping's recent announcement, which is quite extraordinary and could have a very profound effect on the world, that they would be carbon neutral by 2060, they would have peak in carbon emissions by 2030. If you look at the way they've opened their financial markets and investors around the world are rushing in to buy Chinese bonds, you can find some things that they're doing which are quite reasonable and bespeak of a great power seeking legitimate global stature. However, if you just kind of flip the lens over, you find, and some of you have alluded to these things, I mean, you find a China that is antagonizing the most extraordinary list of countries. You remember the old non-aligned countries? Well, almost every one of them now has had some bad experience with China. There's India, Ladakh, what's happened there? We don't need to get into it. You look at the way China has treated Australia, calling Australia, their ambassador there, the gum on the shoes of China that they could scrape off whenever they want to. China is Australia's largest trading partner. You look at what's happened in Hong Kong, the South China Sea, and we'll get to Taiwan. You look at what happened when the THAAD missile system was put into Korea. You've got a very, very punitive program, which the Koreans have not forgotten, even though they feel they're caught in the middle and can't always speak as freely as they would like to, because they have really no choice to escape the China market. You look at what's gone on in Canada, there's been allusions to that, to Sweden, to Norway, the Czech Republic. In other words, the other side of China's split personality is this very sort of belligerent, aggressive, provocative power that seeks to hector and bully and get its way through market force or perhaps to come military force. How you square these things, that's really a subject for another conversation. But I think that the latter impulse is going to be the more powerful impulse that guides Xi Jinping, because he seems to have a deep sense of historical grievance, that his notion of rejuvenation of the China dream are just drenched in this notion of sort of Lenin's notions of imperialism and predatory behavior that needs to be righted, needs to be rectified. And I think part of Xi's vision is a China that nobody can boss around, that can always get its way, because just like the great powers of old, it can victimize other countries. And this raises the rather, I think, unsettling specter of Taiwan. Now, this idea of the Chinese motherland, which is really a replication of sort of the Qing dynasty imperium. Remember, the Ming dynasty had no Tibet, it had no Xinjiang, had no Mongolia, had no Manchuria, didn't even have a Taiwan attached to it. So this is a kind of a latter day notion of China at its grandest. And this is what I think Xi Jinping wants to replicate. And here is where I think the question of system and values is extremely important, because we have a clash of just such principles in the Taiwan Straits and between China and the United States. Even though we don't always live up to our principles as well as we'd like to, still, that is a contradiction, that is an animating force that I think you cannot ignore. It's not a trade war alone. It's not a military competition alone. It really gets down to the heart of the matter of values. And here, I think, is why the Taiwan issue is not only fraught, because it is the next task on the great rejuvenation and the reunification of the Chinese motherland, but because we have two Chinese societies, one embracing democracy, one embracing authoritarianism. So what should we do about that? This is really, I think, where we should end this long series of wonderful gatherings. My own view is that we do need to rediscuss strategic ambiguity, but we have to be very, very careful that in doing it, we don't come up with some overzealous solution that leads to precisely the outcome that we're trying to avoid, namely provoking China into some sort of action. I think the best antidote to that really unwelcome ending is collective action. And here, I think China has really left the pieces lying on the floor, ready for some august form of leadership, and I hope it's American, to help the world pick up. Because, as I said, it has alienated almost everybody with its wolf warrior diplomacy. Now, that doesn't mean it doesn't have economic clout, military clout, and other cards it can play and will play and has played very successfully. But it means that right now there is something of a moment. And I think the way we ought to move is first to articulate the alliance with Europe, to form some common principles about how we relate to Taiwan as a kind of a practice game, to remind ourselves that we are not just in the transatlantic alliance together, we are in the world together, and we're in Asia together. And then I think if we can come to some rough conclusions there and rally some of those key countries into a concerted action, we should move on to Asia and sort of try to take the next step forward, which is to look at our alliances there and see if we can't come up with some common principles. Because I think that if we don't, Taiwan could not be only be the undoing of Asia, but it, of course, would be the undoing of the 40 years of engagement that we struggled, we tried to somehow peacefully help find a way that China might molt out of its old revolutionary Maoist period. I think we have to admit we failed there. I don't personally think it was wrong to try. I think it was the height of American diplomacy to try. It didn't work. And now we're left with trying to not see that spark lit that's going to create the prairie fire that Mao spoke of, which could be Taiwan. That is the next issue. That is the thing that I think could blow the whole powder keg up in Asia. And it deserves our closest attention. And I do not think it's simply an American problem. It must be a global problem. And that is the challenge of American leadership, is to lead it into that new framework where everybody says, yes, this is a danger to all of us. We've got to think of a sensible collective way to respond. So let me stop there.
What I wish for is that we had another 2.5 hours to continue this discussion, just as what I would wish for is an early transition to democracy in mainland China. But what we have today is 20 minutes rather than 2.5 hours. So the way I want to proceed now is to ask each of the six of you in probably 2 minutes, three at most, to reflect on what the others have said, respond to whatever ideas and arguments have been made, rebut what you wish. And I will give you some specific charges as well for your final round, which you can take up or not as you wish. To Misha, who is not only our Japan expert, but I think one of the leading scholars of contemporary Japan and its role in Asia and in kind of recent history in the United States, how are the Japanese thinking about this now? And in particular, how will the transition to the post-Abe era, affect this, with Prime Minister Abe maybe having had an inclination toward a more robust and forward-leaning Japanese role in security and defense than some think his successor might. To Liz, let me ask you to wear your hat as an expert on China's domestic politics and take on, if you will, this question. If Xi Jinping is there for life now, or for a stay in office much longer than the 10 years of his two predecessors, can he afford to go on indefinitely with no progress on this front? To all of you, including Liz, I'll pose this reflection. I feared in August of 2019, when it was reported that China was massing security forces over the border from Hong Kong, that China was going to invade Hong Kong. I even wrote an article warning about Tiananmen massacre in Hong Kong. And I think I greatly underestimated Xi Jinping. Because, of course, that would have been a tragic and horrific thing, but it also would have been a very stupid thing geopolitically. What Beijing has done in Hong Kong is ugly and bad enough, but it's been a lot more skillful than Tiananmen Square. And might China use the same incremental tactics of strangulation and pressure and gradual deconstruction of democratic will that it's been using in Hong Kong? Well, in a different kind of way. And just to give you one example, what if the PRC simply says these outer islands, largely uninhabited, like the Pratas Islands, they're ours. We've said said they're ours. Now
you don't need a massive amphibious force to take some of these outer islands of Taiwan. And, you know, the world, is the world going to do anything in response to that? Is that going to change calculations and mentality? And I will ask Jim and
HR, as colleagues with their bulk of their careers in the armed forces, how do we change the way Americans think about this challenge and prepare them to begin to think that, you know, if we don't pose a credible threat of military response and a national readiness to respond against outright military aggression, you know, we'll see a repeat of what happened in Europe in the 1930s. To Tom, I would ask you the same thing, and ask you also if you think she can survive politically indefinitely without some demonstrated progress toward unification. And then, of course, I invite you all to respond to whatever any of your colleagues have said, and how you're going to do that all in 2 or 3 minutes, I don't know. But HR, we're going to begin with you, and then we'll proceed in order. Please go ahead.
Okay, so thank you. What a rich discussion, and what a privilege to be part of this. I would just say, Larry, it's deterrence by denial. It goes back to Thomas Schelling and his writings in the 60s, right? We have to convince the Chinese Communist Party and PLA leadership that they can't accomplish their objectives through the use of force. And so as Jim Ellis was talking, others were talking, I was thinking of the Finland analogy, right? And how important it is for Taiwan to build up its defenses and to make it clear, you know, that that China can accomplish its objectives through the use of force, but then also for us to take that approach broadly throughout the region through what you're seeing already, which is increased cooperation among like-minded countries who are concerned about China's efforts to create these servile relationships and to create these exclusionary areas of privacy. But I would just comment quickly, Larry, your comments about being really surprised by how effective China was at extinguishing or repressing at least freedom in Hong Kong by not taking a direct approach. I think deterrence now has to be thought of more broadly in terms of deterring also those actions that fall below the threshold that might elicit a concerted military response. And that is really what others have been talking about on the panel as well, really the important competence of integrating all elements of national power and efforts of like-minded partners. And those elements of power include obviously diplomacy and information and law enforcement actions, as we talked about, cyber actions in connection with sustained campaigns of cyber espionage. But I'll turn it over to Admiral Ellis, but I think that this is exactly the discussion we need to have, is a discussion around, as we have on the panel, how to deter, how to make it clear with that combination of will and capabilities, not just the U.S., right, but like like-minded countries and Taiwan in particular, with the armed forces, its armed forces, and the reforms and the modernization effort that is ongoing there. But Jim, any further comments?
No, I certainly agree with that, and I'm not preordaining outcomes here, but I think to get a bit more specific about what HR is talking about, deterrence comes in many, many forms, and when we talk about it, we tend to think the catechism of the nuclear age, where you know you couldn't open an issue of foreign affairs without getting somebody's assessment whether some element of strategy or policy was stabilizing or destabilizing. I think we have to think about that differently now. And there are things that we can do at the tactical level that can have very strategic consequences in terms of deterrence and denial. And HR knows them well. You know, we've seen it play out in other wars and other conflicts where low-end, low-tech capabilities can make the probabilities of a successful amphibious assault are very, very different. So we're not talking about something that would unfold over 30 to 40 years. First off, it's not responsive to need. We can't wait for, you know, the vaunted now 345 ship Navy, which is decades away. We can't accept that as we thought we would be able to do for years, surge from the East Coast or from the West Coast and still get there in time. It's a 3-week journey at best. The pivot to the Pacific really hasn't been much of one in terms of real force structure and the like. And so there are things we can think about, some in the classified domain, some not, that we need to talk about. But to weigh into something, an area where I'm not an expert, but where I echo what we've heard from Orville and from others, we need to think about this differently. We need to have that awareness, and I don't want to compare it to the dark days of 39 and the like, but those kinds of that kind of awareness and that kind of education, I think, is going to be important going forward. I mean, I'm a big fan of a poem by Auden that he wrote. He says, in September of 1939, I sit in one of the dives on 52nd Street, uncertain and afraid, as the clever hopes expire of a low, dishonest decade. We can't continue to delude ourselves that things are the same as they always were. Things have changed, as Tom reminded us. They've changed within China. They're still changing within China. They've changed here. I mean, you want to look at change, look in the mirror in the United States over the last 4 to 5 years and how we think about this dynamic. And it's the engineer in me, and I apologize, but take a systems approach to dealing with all of these elements rather than look at them in isolation. I think we might be able to define a way forward that can accomplish the goals I think we all share. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Misha, so much has been made of the importance of our allies in the region. None of those allies is more powerful and more important than Japan. So give us your thoughts about that and anything else.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. Very briefly, in 2 minutes, what did very much leap out to me was Liz's call to multilateralize the Taiwan issue and Orville's similar call for collective action. But being a far less subtle thinker than Orville, I was thinking we should start with Asia as opposed to Europe. And doing that, we would start with Japan. And just my approach probably coming from the Japan side of things, which leads into your question about how the Japanese are thinking about this. I would just there's so much to say, but I've just mentioned two things. First, Taiwan is a near existential issue, I think, in Japanese eyes, meaning if Taiwan is successfully absorbed or Finlandized or neutralized anywhere along the spectrum, I think Tokyo feels that its strategic maneuver dramatically shrinks in the region, in part from what you could see as an extension of the second island chain out past Japan into the Western Pacific, so that the country would actually feel separated from its traditional access into the Pacific, that the U.S. being so far away would not be able to protect it, that it too could be encircled. So it really looks very carefully at this, and that's why I think you see a lot of actions that are between Tokyo and Taipei that we should be encouraging, partnership and similarity of thought about rules and norms in the region. The second thing I would mention goes to U.S. credibility, our credibility in the eyes of Japan over Taiwan, that if we failed in, and strategic ambiguity I think is getting a little thin on the ground, if we failed in protecting Taiwan, which whether or not we have overtly said we would, that is certainly the implication that we've given, that the stance, not that Tokyo itself would question the alliance, but that it believes all of our other allies would question their alliances with us, probably most particularly South Korea. And therefore they would find themselves alone in an Asia with the US as a no longer as credible partner as before, but with no other potential partners to work from. And I think that actually is why Abe, during his 8 years in office, worked so hard to deepen Japan's relations with India, with Australia, and with Southeast Asia. And to wind up, I would simply say, your question about Suga, current prime minister, he was Abe's right-hand man. He was there, you know, through the whole way. He understands this. The Japanese are trying to send very strong signals that Suga is going to continue the same policy, but that's dependent on our credibility and our being the guarantor of stability. And so that's why Taiwan, I think, is central, is a linchpin to all of that in the Japanese eyes. Thanks.
Liz?
Great. Thanks, Larry. And I've really enjoyed everybody's remarks. I guess I was struck by Tom's point about being careful about projecting and trying to ensure that we understand what, in fact, are the roots of Chinese behavior and not being overly deterministic. And I guess I might just say, coming as somebody who has studied Xi Jinping now for a little bit, that we have 8 years of Xi Jinping as China's leader. And we've got 2,000 odd pages of his speeches. And that we can actually, I think, discern a pattern in Xi's behaviors and the direction in which he's leading the country. You know, it has to do with his consolidation of power and his reassertion of the role of the Communist Party. And, you know, his, and I can't remember who mentioned this, but his determination to keep outside influences from coming in, and his much more ambitious and expansive foreign policy. He really is a person who, you know, if you read his speeches, he does what he says he's going to do. It might take him a little bit of time. He might do one step forward and two steps back, but I actually believe we can have a fairly good understanding of the direction in which he wants to move this country. And Orville's point notwithstanding about sort of the dichotomy of a Xi Jinping who has a Belt and a Road and can be open, the Belt and Road nonetheless is a very self-serving initiative, you know, for China. And even, you know, when you look at the carbon, my favorite thing to think about sometimes is that the pledge on carbon neutrality at 2060 is really the one pledge that I've ever seen Xi Jinping make where he's not going to be alive to have to realize it. So in any case, I think it is important, and I hope that it does drive China in the right direction. But overall, I would say I think we have we are developing a pretty good sense of the direction in which this country is moving. And so to just answer quickly your question, Larry, about whether or not Xi Jinping can last without actually taking action in Taiwan, I think that just it depends on the direction in which Taiwan moves. To the extent that we see greater agitation for more independence, if the United States continues to support Taiwan potentially in ways, especially through Congress passage of a lot of legislation that seems to, elevate Taiwan in many directions in which Beijing would find threatening, then I would expect that Beijing will take action. Again, Xi Jinping has said this is a core priority of his. And it's different, I think, Tom, from the way that that previous leaders have talked about Taiwan. And so I would anticipate that there is not much maneuvering space for Taiwan right now. What gives Taiwan more maneuvering space is to tamp down the rhetoric, to reaffirm the relationship, to be quiet, to do what China does so well, which is, or used to do so well, which was hide the brightness, cherish obscurity, and then change the facts on the ground. It's not to say that we shouldn't do a lot of what we've been doing, but we don't need to make a big production about it. So I'll stop there.
Liz, the president of your Council on Foreign Relations has called for lifting strategic ambiguity, which is a striking statement from someone as sober and pragmatic as Richard Haass. The implication of what you've just said is that could have the paradoxical effect of provoking China to take actions it wouldn't otherwise do. Is that your view?
So what I would say is I think it's great. We've had this debate. The ideas are out there. And that should be enough to give Chinese the message that, in fact, this is being talked about and it's serious. And, we can always fall back and do what the Chinese do and say, it's just the will of the American people, So. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Very artfully expressed. Tom?
Let me begin by agreeing with Liz on the utility of strategic ambiguity. And the, admonition to Taiwan to be cautious, that I think we should be avoiding things that Beijing could construe as a provocation to which it has to respond. To Larry's question of can she survive without reunifying the country, we don't want to learn the answer to that question, and therefore to be prudent. But another part of the answer, and here I come at it from a different perspective than Liz does, which I will exaggerate as Liz thinks she owns the party. I think the party owns she. It's gross oversimplification, and I've got enormous respect for Liz's judgments on this. But I've called she a scapegoat in waiting. If, or to the extent he succeeds, the party succeeds. If he doesn't fail, the party dumps him in a heartbeat. As at whatever point he jeopardizes the party and the party state system, he's history. The flip side of all of the responsibility loaded on him is it's clearly his screw up if it occurs. I think reunification with Taiwan, though a high profile goal, is probably less important than lots of other goals in the declared objectives for the 100th anniversary of the party and the 100th anniversary of the PRC for 2021 and 2049, which are a lot of those are improving the economic status, the technological levels, the health of the Chinese people. Really important goals, cleaning up the environment, safe food, all of that stuff. Achieving all of them is going to be extraordinarily difficult. Achieving some of them is attainable. Which ones? Which ones are emphasized? I think when you get below the people's daily kind of rhetoric about the feelings of the Chinese people, reunification with Taiwan is lower priority than a healthcare system that is affordable, is care for mom and dad and grandma and grandpa. Who pays for that? Because it can't be done by the family when you've only got one child. That there, and multiply that by many other examples. So how the system allocates priorities, how it allocates effort and resources, the criteria it uses for success or backing off, how it is perceived by the people of China, which matters. That domestic instability, I think, is the greatest fear of the party and of Xi. So the question becomes, if Finger's analysis is sort of right, and the party state runs into trouble because it's produced insufficient benefits over whatever the time period is for to meet the demands and expectations of the Chinese people, is the response divert attention by a conflict with Taiwan or moving in a way that, as Jim indicated, is not going to be easy, right? That's embarking on a high risk, high profile undertaking. Or is it going to be respond to the failure by retreating towards something more like the Deng notion of reform and opening, begin to make more changes and recognize that China's future lies through participation with and within the rules-based order?
Great, thank you, Tom. Orville, before I give HR the last word, I'll let you wrap up here. And in addition to whatever else you were going to say, if you had an opportunity to speak to the American people as one and tell them why you think we should care about Taiwan, I wonder how you'd put it.
Okay, well, thanks, Larry. You know, if Jim Ellis can quote Auden, perhaps I can move from the sacred to the profane and quote Buffalo Springfield. I'm not sure we're in a Cold War or what we're in, but you may remember the lines, there's something happening here. But what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. Okay. And I think we should stand up to this. I think we need deterrence. I think we need to arch our backs. But I want to also counsel you all that there's another side to being a leader, and that is to always keep the door open for diplomacy. And I do not think we have adequate institutional frameworks at this point to talk to Xi. And I think that should be the highest order, so there can be no mistakes, so the off ramps are clear. There can always be an exit, and I think that is the other side of that should never for a moment be overlooked, or we risk, as I say, ending up exactly where we're trying to avoid.
HR, do you have any closing words?
Yeah, my only comment would be what a great panel, and I would just say I know that there have been some warnings about, you know, speaking softly. I think, Liz, you would prefer that I would at times as well. but I do think that what we do want to do, and I had the opportunity to talk about this with Taiwanese friends about a month and a half ago. We do need to amplify Taiwan's voice. We need to amplify Taiwan's voice in international fora. We need to amplify Taiwan's voice as an example of a successful democracy, to undercut this narrative that the Chinese people really, you know, by culture are culturally predisposed toward not wanting a say in how they're governed. And so I think that, you know, while we want to avoid any kind of jingoistic rhetoric that could be seen as provocative, we also don't want to shy away from either pointing out the Chinese Communist Party's aggression or shy away from amplifying the voice of the Taiwanese people. And I know that those who commented about rhetoric and so forth weren't implying that, but I just thought I'd take the advantage of the opportunity to qualify the previous conversation just slightly. But what a privilege, Larry. Thanks for the opportunity to be with you.
Great. Well, thank you, HR, and thank all five of you for your tremendous contributions today and throughout this conference. I'll take up my own challenge and say, I think there's great wisdom in what each of you have said, even though I may not agree exactly and fully with everything that each of you have said, which would be impossible since you disagree with one another. I would like to add that I think beyond all of the strategic imperatives, beyond the obvious fact that Taiwan is now really not only one of the most liberal, effective, successful, and in many ways for people who have been there, inspirational democracies in Asia, and one of the most successful so-called third wave democracies, it is a democracy where people exercise freedom and the right of self-determination. And if it were the case that in authoritarian power, and of course, the world's most powerful authoritarian power, in my view, I know that not everyone will agree, a neo-totalitarian power, were to end that democracy and impose its will by force, I think it would be a world historical development on a par with what happened in Europe and at a minimum in Czechoslovakia in the 1930s. And that is why personally, I think, to round out my own thinking, it's an existential issue, not only for US national security, but frankly, for the future of freedom in the world. With that, I want to offer my vote of thanks, not only to all of you, but to my colleagues who have produced this remarkable six-part conference, my co-leader of this project, Glenn Tiffert, to Janet Smith, Brittany Volker, and Amy Alonso, our wonderful staff at the Hoover Institution, to all of the panelists and chairs of the previous sessions, to once again, the Taipei Economic and Cultural Office. I want to note that with the mounting work level of our China Global Sharp Power Project, Glenn Tiffert will now be stepping back as program manager of this project on Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific region to focus his leadership more fully on the China part of this, and we will welcome back to the project management role the exceptional scholar of Taiwan who had that responsibility when this project was at the Freeman Spogli Institute, Karis Templeman. So Karis, I welcome you and thank you for taking on this responsibility again. Finally, I invite all of you to join us tomorrow at noon Pacific time for a special session of our China Global Sharp Power Project, in which the current Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs, David Stilwell, will join us for a discussion, Covert, Coercive, and Corrupt, Countering Chinese Communist Party Malign Influence in Free Societies. And in that session, he will be joined in discussion by Tom Finger's colleague at the Shorenstein A. Park Center, Oriana Schuyler Mastro, and by our own, thank you again for taking it on, Orville Schell. I am Larry Diamond, and I thank you once again for sticking with us through this remarkable conference. Have a good evening.